This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Klein Avenue Bridge, which is the new toll bridge, is being built in East Chicago over the Indiana Harbor and Ship Canal, is moving toward completion. Let's get an update on the project and the marketing, too, because we happen to have both Terry Velligan, who's the general manager for operations, and Laura Weber, who does a lot of the marketing and community involvement for the project for Klein Avenue Bridge, LLC, with us on the program today. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be here.
Well, Terry, let's start with you. If you will bring us an up-to-date on how the project is doing, and also, too, if you'll take some time and talk about, which we've had in our last big conversation, about some of the engineering concepts that were behind the big design that will make this bridge very unique in itself. But first, let's get an update on how the construction project's going itself.
Well, thank you, Chris. I appreciate you having us on. The bridge progress is going really well. We're actually, in terms of construction, about halfway with construction and erection of the segments. If anybody's been out to the site, we're to the canal, which is the Indiana Harbor Shipping Canal, and we just made it over what we call the east side, and we have erection crews out there on the east side putting up the segment. So part of the uniqueness of this project is actually the segments themselves. We have a box girder construction that we precasted 685 segments in a building that we built specifically to make the segment so we could make those year-round. We completed that last year. And we have 685 segments to go up, and we're well on our way to complete this project with the erection. So part of that also is that we're simultaneously putting in the tolling system and also the lighting and cameras for the bridge. So we have a lot of other things going on just besides the erection, but everything is moving along really well.
Now you talk about these additional systems that are going up as well as are the segments to get the bridge moving toward completion. We've talked, of course, about the light. Obviously, the lighting is something important. What are the cameras going to be able to do when they're all up and running?
So we have cameras all along our bridge, which starts, if anybody's familiar with SR-912, which we call Klein Avenue, it starts as soon as you go north on Klein Avenue and enter into East Chicago. We have cameras up on the lighting poles so we could monitor any slowdowns, any accidents, or emergency response teams. So it's valuable to us to help ensure that anybody who's traveling on the bridge has a safe and efficient passage over the canal.
We had our earlier conversation. You spoke at length about the work that was involved in getting the plan together, because obviously that you folks wanted to have a design that was not only a sound one, to be sure, but also it seemed to be rather unique. Is this bridge that is going up over Klein Avenue, over the canal in East Chicago, unique in its own right, or is it like maybe some others that might be similar in design?
This bridge design has been used for many years. We just perfected the construction, and we're always looking for better ways and more efficient ways to construct. So we've taken technology a next step in terms of quality control. Our primary goal is obviously safe and quality with our bridge. Part of it is with that box girder, we're able to make a structure that is more sturdy and sound and easier to construct. Now, one of the unique things about this bridge also is that from the east and west, you could actually walk all the way through the bridge on the inside, which allows us to look for other companies or collaboration to put utilities inside the bridge, much like fiber optic or water or electric. So we're in the process of looking for customers that need fiber optic that we could actually put through the bridge where it's not exposed to the element.
I imagine that's probably the biggest advantage, that you've got it completely enclosed, and you can take advantage of that complete enclosure to help put in more services, and that's certainly the
Correct.
One too. So what kind of... comments. I know recently, let's turn now to Laura, because I think that you were the one working the closest on the recent Cocoa with Klein informational session that was held last week at the East Chicago Public Library. What kind of information did you gather together from of what you and Terry have worked on all this time to be able to present the folks that showed up for the event and explain to them how this is really going to affect the community of East Chicago and all of Northwest Indiana?
That's a great question. Thank you. So the primary thing we wanted to do is just provide clarity on the entrances and exits, how it'll work, how the tolls will be collected, create awareness, and provide a forum for any questions to be asked. And one of the other main things that we did was just provide some insight on how it's being built. So there's a few aspects we talk about when we do these kind of events. There's the construction aspect and the operation. So the construction is neat in and of its own right because it provides people a chance to see behind the scenes of a project that's really huge in scale. It's a mile-long brand-new construction. It's 100 feet tall at its highest. So it's for all ages, it's really cool for people to learn just exactly what it takes, whether you're a student considering going into the engineering field or if you're just a citizen wondering about what's this new thing in our backyard? What's it going to, how's it made and how's it going to work? So there's a construction aspect and then there's the operational part too. People want to know, since it's a whole new bridge, how are they going to get to it? How does it work? How does tolling work? So, and some people who haven't been in this area for a long time too, we're seeing that not everybody knows where this project is. So it's really fun to see when that aha moment happens, when we say, okay, you can get from South Lake County to Chicago in practically the blink of an eye, and they realize that finally there's going to be an alternative to the Borman in 1894. It's like, wait a minute, I can bypass that? So it's people from a lot of diverse perspectives coming and getting something out of it. So that's our goal, is to deliver information and provide a chance for people to ask questions because there's a lot of curiosity and people want to know how it's going to affect them. So the series that we're just starting has been really helpful with that so far.
How many more of these, maybe not necessarily Cocoa, but certainly a chance to meet with the Klein Avenue folks, Klein Avenue Bridge folks to talk about, how many more of these are you planning?
Right now, the sky's the limit. Uh-huh. I'm actually today, I'm still working on lining up more of these events. So we're looking at partnering with local libraries in Lake County. There's really no limit to it, but we're focusing on a handful of the community libraries around us. So really there's no limit right now, but just our time and the opportunities. So, but we'll be sure to share that information on Facebook when we have that series set. They can definitely check Facebook and Twitter to find out when and where those will be. So those are in development, and I look forward to bringing more to the community.
Now, Terry, let's revisit some of the conversation we had last time when we first got the big at-large view of what the project is all about. You mentioned about how the history of Northwest Indiana is with transportation, the snarls that we have, as you kind of mentioned just a moment ago, Laura, about the issues on the Borman Expressway and how the Klein Avenue Bridge is going to alleviate a lot of these things. What were some of the things that you learned as being a native of the region that you think that this bridge is going to be able to impart to residents when they come here, especially the residents who've been here all their lives and don't know very much about anything other than the old bridge?
That's a good question, and there's a lot of benefits for this bridge back in service after 10 years. One, it'll bring more commerce and economic development into areas that were kind of shut off from the rest of Lake County, much like obviously East Chicago, Gary, Hammond, things of that nature. So the snarls that we have on the Borman, we have 180,000 vehicles every day crossing the Borman where Klein Avenue and the Borman connect. So it's a short route to Illinois and out of Illinois. So a lot of people that want to go to Chicago and or vice versa, people from Chicago want to visit a lot of our lakefront, which we just got designated 61st National Park. There's a lot of tourist destinations in Northwest Indiana that this will help open up. So there's a lot of benefit. One of the other benefits I think we talked before about specifically to East Chicago, that 10 cents on every toll will go back to East Chicago. So they could use that money however they see fit to either redo their streets or put in new parks or things of that nature.
Now, I mentioned there was quite a concern about that.
We also looked at is, you know, there's a lot of people moving to South County, and they might be wanting to go to Chicago, or they might move to South County and still work in Chicago. So this is a much more efficient route to get from their house in South Lake County to Chicago or Illinois.
Take a moment, if you will, how this layout is going to be here when the bridge is completed this year, I guess I understand this summer sometime, and more people will, with the warmer weather, want to be out there and certainly to get on it. If anything, they'll be curious to find out what the bridge is really like. What's the best? What are going to be some of the best routes for folks to be able to get to the bridge and, as you say, make that connection over into Illinois?
That's a good question, because it's really easy to get to the bridge if you're South County or near the Borman or near Klein Avenue. Take Klein Avenue north and continue on essentially from the Borman all the way to the Illinois border. There's no stop and go. The other thing is, it intersects 12 and 20. If you're coming from the east, just jump on 12 and 20 and you connect right to North Klein Avenue. Head North Klein Avenue into East Chicago, and it's a seamless direction up to the Klein Avenue Bridge. It's pretty easy to get to. If you're coming from Munster or Schererville, you could take Calumet Avenue to the Borman, go east to Klein Avenue and Klein Avenue North. So it's really easy. There's no stop and go to get to the bridge, and once we're up in operation, there's no gates for the toll gantry. It's all electronic. There's no stop and go. So it's very easy, very efficient design to get to Chicago or out of Lake County into Chicago or from Chicago to Lake County.
We've kind of focused on vehicular traffic. How about the truck traffic? Because we know that the Borman Expressway is really cram-packed with trucks all the time. Mm-hmm. And they'll obviously, they've had probably in some cases had to make that route because of the fact that Klein Avenue has been closed, the bridge has been down. And when it comes up, how much truck traffic are you expecting or hoping to get once things are complete?
So we're anticipating about 10,000 vehicles a day on the bridge. And about 10 to 15% of that will be truck traffic. So we anticipate 15% of 10,000 will come off the Borman or off of ITR, which is Indiana Toll Road, and use our bridge. So that'll help a lot of cities out, too, because right now the trucks have to find an alternate route since this bridge was down. That'll alleviate a lot of damage to the inner city streets, whether it be Chicago, Gary, or Hammond. So we anticipate a big truck volume, as we say in the industry, coming on the Klein Avenue Bridge.
Well, Terry and Laura, thank you very much for spending time with us to bring us up to date on the latest on the Klein Avenue Bridge project that is underway there in East Chicago. And I guess with the warmer weather, you'll get be able to get more segments together, get things all locked up, so to speak, and have that bridge ready to be open sometime I guess in the summer months. Is that what you're planning on right now?
Yes, we're anticipating an opening between the second and third quarter of this year. So we're looking at the summertime.
That's great to hear. Something to plan on for summer travel and for people trying to make it to and from Illinois, the faster way to be sure when it's all done. And thank you both for being with us to give us the update and to keep us informed on what is happening with the Klein Avenue Bridge project.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Terry Velligan's the General Manager of Operations, and Laura Weber is in charge of Marketing and Communications for Klein Avenue Bridge LLC, which is the organization that is putting up the Klein Avenue Bridge here in Lake County. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Time once again for Building Northwest Indiana, and here's your host, Kevin Comerford.
Welcome to another edition of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Comerford. In today's episode, we'll conclude a three-part segment about careers in the construction trades. If you missed part one or two, you can find them on the website at lakeshorepublicradio.org. Today, I want to talk a little bit about the general minimum qualifications for getting into the construction industry. And again, you can find this information at WeBuildNWI.com. The first thing is you must be 18 years old. You know, a lot of the insurance policies won't even let you go into an apprenticeship training center without being 18 years old. You're going to be operating heavy equipment or, you know, power tools, and, you know, the insurance policies just dictate you have to be 18 years old. You can apply when you're 17, but as long as the first day of school, you're 18, you're good to go. You must have a valid driver's license. The one thing about construction is you're typically not reporting to the same place every day. You have to go where the project is. So one day you might be working in the refinery at BP. Another day you might be on a bridge down by the Kankakee River. You might be working at the NIPSCO plant up in Michigan City. So you got to be able to go where the work's at. So that's why a valid driver's license key. Another key thing is reliable transportation. And then last but not least, you must be drug-free. There's absolutely no tolerance for drug use in the construction industry. Working around potentially dangerous situations, moving equipment, you're working at height, so everybody has to be of sound mind on the job site. So everybody who gets into the industry is randomly tested, so there's absolutely no tolerance for drug use in our industry. There are a couple downsides, and I guess not everything is great. One thing that is the work's not easy. You know, it's very physically demanding. You're lifting heavy materials. You're climbing ladders. You're working in tight spaces. You got to work in the elements. Sometimes you're going to be working next to a blast furnace in the extreme heat of summer, and other times you might be working outside during deep freezes in the winter. So you got to be able to work in the elements. You're going to be on call a lot, especially if there's an emergency. If a customer has a process emergency or a unit shutdown, they need our best people out there. And so there's a lot of, depending on what contractor you work for, you might be on call. And like I said earlier, the work is potentially dangerous. You're working at heights, working in confined spaces. I do have to say that the unions and the contractors do whatever is necessary to make sure that their workers are safe. They offer you the top-of-the-line PPE, and that's personal protection equipment. They offer you safety training. The Construction Advancement Foundation offers safety training that supplements what's offered by the unions. Like I said, there's drug testing. I guess one other downside is the work is not guaranteed. Our industry depends on how the overall economy is doing. So if the overall economy is not doing very well, our industry tends to struggle a little bit. So there's no guaranteed work. You're very dependent on your employer to win jobs as well. So everything's very competitive among contractors. And if your contractors aren't winning work, you might be laid off. But usually if another contractor doesn't get the job, another contractor will. So you could go work for different employers. The system is set up like that. So you can go work for other companies, but still collect your pension, still collect your health benefits. It's all shared by the employers in what they call multi-employer systems. So one of the last things, it's kind of hard to get into a trade. I know a lot of people that apply, you know, since the jobs are in such high demand that they attract, and the pay is good, it attracts a lot of people into the apprenticeship program. But the unions can only, and the contractors can only take as many people that they feel that they can employ on an annual basis. For example, I went to the ironworker, they did an apprenticeship acceptance last year, and I would say there was about 400 apprentices applying, and they took about 50 people. So they're only looking for the best of the best, and like I said, they can only take in what they employ. So they kind of look at who's retiring and who left the industry, and that's how they determine and what kind of work is upcoming in the near future, and that's kind of how they determine who they could take in every year. A little bit about the application process. Like I said, you could go to We Build Northwest Indiana. It's all right there on that website. Like I said, each trade has their own process for accepting applicants, but it's pretty much the same across the board. You're generally going to fill out an application, and then once your application is filled out, and I should say you should do a complete application. I would say half the people eliminate themselves because they don't fill out a complete application. A lot of it requires you to get high school transcripts and things of that sort, turn in a resume, maybe some letters of reference. And if you don't complete all those steps, they're just going to throw away your application. So make sure you complete the application. Then you typically go through a general aptitude test. We actually put a sample test on the We Build Northwest Indiana website. So it had compiled all the questions that you might get from the various trades. So if you could go to the website and go through that test and pass it, you shouldn't have any issues getting into, you know, passing the aptitude test for any of these trades. And then after that, there's an interview. And during the interview, you're going to be asked, you know, why do you want to join this trade? I think that's probably the number one thing you should know is, why do you want to join that trade? So definitely research the trade. There's a lot of information on YouTube and on the web on where you could research, you know, the different trades. And just be prepared to talk about yourself. Talk about why you want to get into the trades. You know, a lot of times saying I'm here for the money, that doesn't work. You know, they want to hear things like I like working with my hands. I like making a difference. Definitely, you know, research the trade and know why you want to get into the trade. And then the last thing I want to talk about is managerial careers. This is more of your college career path, but I would say there's a lot of people that get into management careers going through the trades and then going into college. Actually, I think those people are most employable. If you have a trade under your belt and then get into a four-year institution and get an organizational leadership supervision degree, a health and safety degree, or a construction management degree, I don't think you'll ever be without a job. The college career path is pretty much a direct shot into management. Some of the careers that exist are, you know, project engineer, project manager, project estimators, superintendents and foremen. If you don't know about a project engineer, they're pretty much the liaison between the project manager and the field. They're responsible for the oversight of most major aspects of the construction work. They procure a lot of the construction materials and equipment for the job site. They do a lot of cost control, managing the project so that it's within the budget. They do a lot of quality control, and they do a lot of daily reports and just permitting. I think one of the highest paid careers in management would be a project manager. They're the ones that pretty much plan and oversee entire construction projects. They need to ensure that they are completed on time and within budget. They prepare budgets, they monitor progress, communicate with all the stakeholders, communicate with the field, communicate with the project engineers. Another key position in management are estimators. I see a lot of estimators come up through the fields and the trades, but I see a lot of more and more I'm seeing more take the college route. But they just basically estimate labor and material cost, and they're very instrumental in helping contractors secure contractors and get work. And then lastly, one of the other key pieces of management is the superintendent. Again, traditionally in our industry, those people have come through the skilled trades and then worked their way up into the field supervision. But more and more, I'm starting to see contractors hire people who have gone through college or people who have been through the trades and then also supplemented that with a four-year degree. Now, they oversee the operations on the project site. They supervise all activities. They go over the daily schedules, and they ensure people's safety on the job site. Well, that's all the time I have today on Building Northwest Indiana. If you're interested in a career in the Northwest Indiana construction industry, you can find out more information at WeBuildNWI.com or just do an internet search for We Build Northwest Indiana. I'm your host, Kevin Comerford.
Support for Building Northwest Indiana comes from the Construction Advancement Foundation. You can hear Building Northwest Indiana on Tuesdays here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. And the program podcasts are right now at lakeshorepublicradio.org. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
When I was in elementary school, my mom was a stay-at-home mom, so she did all the classroom parties. She was around helping all the time, and I look exactly like my mom. And she's half Mexican, so we both have our darker skin tone. My friends and all my classmates would see, oh, that's your mom. You guys are so much tanner. And I'd come back from the summer and have this nice tan that would hold up most of the school year. And these other kids didn't. And so they just were like, oh, like what? And they at first they'd be like, are you Italian? Are you this? And parents would do this too. Parents would be like, what are you? And finally I was like, you know what? Like my dad's 100 different things. Like I tried to make like this, it was like, I think it was a pie chart for one of my classes in high school. And it was just split 100 different ways, like so many different ways. And my dad has really no idea what he is. We kind of guesstimated. And my mom only knows the part that's Mexican. So that's my majority. And so eventually they were like, what are you? And I'm like, well, I'm Hispanic or Mexican, and I don't really know what else. I think just growing up, they just knew, like, you're tan. You said you were from, you have your grandpa's from Mexico, so you must be Hispanic and you're different. I mean, they didn't treat me differently. I never felt like I was treated differently, but I definitely stood out being like a heavy tan kid in elementary school when I had these skinny white girls all around that were just pale and straight hair and just, I mean, I stood out. It's different because my boyfriend is Czechoslovakian because his grandpa's from Czech and his other grandma's from Czech, and then his other grandma and grandpa are from Slovak, and that was the same country. And it's so funny to see the two grandparents will come together for like Christmas or holidays and they will argue and be like, that's a stupid Czech thing. And I'm like, what are you talking about? That is the same thing. And it's just so weird. When we started dating, I couldn't understand them. And now I'm like, I can understand them clearly. I'm like, hey, Baba. And I was like, introduce, this is Baba. That's Slovak for grandma. Like, and I started eating noodles with cottage cheese the other day. My mom was like, can you just go move with the Slovaks? And I was like, yeah, Mom. Like, I don't know what to tell you. So it's like different that even though like I've only known them for 3 years, I've started picking up on their culture habits. And I think it's amazing that he knows what he is. And he has that full-on, I'm Czechoslovakian, but not a lot of people have that. I think there's a ton of people that just don't know what they really are. They don't know what if they're Polish or German or Irish. I just think there's a big group of people that identify with a lot of different things, and that's what that category is right now. So I don't think there's a strictly white category. I think that's just the default.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Let's continue our conversation with the new mayors here in Northwest Indiana with LaPorte Mayor Tom Dermody. We did have a chance briefly during election night to say hello, although he was pretty busy. He had a big crowd around there, and LaPorte welcoming him to become the new mayor in the city, and we have a few minutes at least to talk with him today. And Mr. Mayor, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Always great to be on, and loving life right now, enjoying the job here over the first 6-7 weeks, and trying to stay busy, which isn't too hard of a issue.
Well, the last time we talked, of course, was in November of last year at the election night. And what have you been able to get done here after the election was over with and before you officially took the position of mayor, rather, on January 1st?
Well, number one was to get a good team in place, which I was fortunate. We have a lot of good people here that were department heads, made a few changes, and we are gelling together and making some impact. And, you know, two of the things that I really spoke about was, number one, code enforcement, because I heard for over 2 years people wanting to clean up our community. And over the first 6 weeks, Jeff Batchelor, our new code enforcement director, he and his team have written over 600 violations, working with individuals in the community to clean up their properties. And I don't think LaPorte has ever seen that. And then as well, you know, working with the new team, the new leadership in our police department under Captain Paul Breton, you know, going after the drug traffickers, making sure they feel uncomfortable and unprofitable in LaPorte. And on day one, day two, we went knocking on doors, made an arrest, and kind of let people know that, hey, we mean business. It wasn't just political spin, and we're out clean it up, and we've got an energized police department that is going out and, as they like to say, getting into stuff and not holding them back.
Were those the two major things that you encountered on the campaign trail last year that you heard the most from LaPorte residents? The fact that the city is great and is in pretty good shape, except for a few things, and the tidiness issue and the crime issue in particular. Or were there some other things that you heard a lot from residents about on the campaign trail that you're now starting to incorporate in your administration?
Well, I think the culture, the mentality that LaPorte can compete with the best, you know, bring the pride back. And that's why for 2 years, again, you heard me talk about LaPorte proud, LaPorte proud, LaPorte proud. Mm-hmm. We are LaPorte proud. And while we have to work regionally with communities like Michigan City and Valparaiso, but we're coming after them too. We're going to compete. And LaPorte has so much to offer with the quality of life, with the type of businesses we have here. So it's really changing the mentality, you know, coming from the legislature, but more importantly, coming from that business mentality of, hey, we're in this to win it, And everything we do has got to make the lives better of our residents or stop doing it. Mm-hmm. And so we have a lot of work ahead of us. But again, with the team that we have in place, I think you're going to continue to see great things out of the city of LaPorte.
Maybe some of our listeners are not all that familiar with the city of LaPorte. Fill us in, if you will, taking a look at what has happened in the recent years. We know that there's been some problems, and everybody in every community here in Northwest Indiana has been dealing with the economic downturn to a point. But I understand that LaPorte got hit pretty hard for a while there. You're on the way back. But just the same, you know, what kind of things did you end up running into that you've had to kind of fight uphill, so to speak, to be able to deal with?
Well, again, I think it's more, you know, you can't always help the things that have happened in the past. All
right.
We can do is move forward. And it's really that mentality to make sure everybody on this team here, but also with the residents, that we're engaging the residents, that they feel part of the changes that need to be happening in our community and the updates, the improvements, and they've really bought in. And that's through social media, through all these other avenues to update them and let them know what's happening. You know, we have one of the other things, you know, the truck traffic off Lincoln Way. We have all these unique businesses coming to our downtown, and we can't have the truck traffic. So working with the state to say, how can we provide alternative options for our truck traffic, looking there. Plus, you know, Ivy Tech, PNW, how do we make these universities, if we're going to be a Gold Star workforce, how do we work with them to provide opportunities for our residents to improve their lives? Because we have jobs to fill right now. And when we talk about business, yes, incentives are important and all of that, but what do they want most of? They want a workforce that will allow them to grow their business. And so we've been doing that, but as well, meeting with, we've held quite a few public meetings. We just had a retail roundtable in our community where retail business owners got to come out, share their thoughts, and what they wanted to see is make sure LaPorte's cleaned up, make sure the police are out keeping everybody safe from the drug traffickers and so forth. And what they've seen is they've been impressed over the first 6 weeks that we are cleaning up. Our curbs are clean. Our Lincoln Way Avenue, which is kind of the cornerstone of our community and where outsiders come in, they're impressed. And now with these businesses joining us, just fantastic.
I know in the past that you've had some good luck with some of the planning that has been done in previous years. In fact, we know that you're, I guess, about halfway or nearly halfway into the five-year master plan for the Parks Department. Tell us a little bit how Bess Rader, who's the Director of Community Development and Planning, has been getting her team together to help not only make LaPorte a better city, but in turn to make it more attractive for new businesses to locate there.
Well, Beth has been a cornerstone of our community, and, you know, she was kind of the lead here on our Chessie Trail, giving options, pedestrian alternatives for walking, biking, providing other options. You know, we're an unhealthy community by statistics, where we're, I think, 92nd out of 92 unhealthy communities in the state, so we have to make some broad changes. She's been the lead on that, you know, and I was so fortunate to have her for 6 weeks. Unfortunately for LaPorte, but a great addition to Mayor Murphy in Valparaiso, they've hired her on as the new developer for Valparaiso. So she's going to do great things for there. She's been fantastic, and I can't tell you enough good things. We're also excited. I've hired Tom Casey, who's been a developer and worked for a company that develops on a national basis, and he's going to be able to step right in, and while he has things to learn, we are excited to have him help us develop some of the opportunities that are in LaPorte.
That's great. Well, you always hope that there's somebody waiting in the wings or somebody that's not too far away that you can bring into a community to help fill a vacancy here. When it's something so important like that, you've got to get somebody in right away so that you don't lose the momentum that you've built up or you're building up. And certainly it takes a lot of work to be able to do that. Fill us in, if you will. First, we'll talk about the infrastructure. How are the streets and the sidewalks doing in LaPorte? What kind of projects are in the works to go into the spring months when the weather improves and you can get some work done out there?
Well, obviously, the paving, there's never enough paving that can be done in a community.
Uh-huh.
So we'll be hard pressed to get all that done. But as well, we're looking at some road opportunities, and we have a wonderful partner, the Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte, where they have contributed millions of dollars to our community to help make things better. And one of the things is going to be a trail and going to a one-way road in our park system along Stone Lake. And they've participated, and we're going to have some great things that will start this year on that. And it's going to give a one-way street for roads as well as, or for cars, but then as well have a biking slash walking area around the lake to get people healthy and enjoy what we have, which is what many communities wish they had, and that's our 6 and 7 lakes in the city limits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems to be important, is to be able to follow through on improving the park system, just keep things up and make things better. And you say the improvement that's planned in particular with the lakes is, I'm sure, going to help. How about festivals and celebrations and other special events that tend to happen through the year in LaPorte? What's in store for 2020, and hope did you be able to expand to that?
Well, one that everybody knows about is our Sunflower Festival, which I think is ripe to compete with the best from the Tulip Festival, Pierogi Fest, any of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great, great event, and we've added a party on the Ave, I think is what we're going to call it, and enjoying something there that evening of the Sunflower Fest, where adults can come out, enjoy themselves. As well, we're going to be introducing Lake Fest 2020, and that's something that Mark Schreiber, the head of our park department, is going to be leading. We're talking about something that can really, really showcase our lakes and maybe some certain races. We have some people flying over from London to see if they want to put us on a circuit of certain races that we'll hopefully be able to announce soon, and then as well build some events around that and make a weekend of it later on this summer. And very excited about those two events.
Wow.
And a great place for LaPorte.
I know that's always the thing. You want to have something that when the weather gets nice, that to bring people into LaPorte. And if you're doing all the work to clean things up and spruce things up, to be sure you want something that will get them over here and keep them coming over here, too. What kind of cooperation do you get with the city of LaPorte from LaPorte County government these days? I know obviously some of it has to come from the from the economic development side. They have a very active area that they're doing to expand business and industry into all of LaPorte County. I'm sure they're helping the city of LaPorte do that as well.
We're working with everybody, the mm-hmm. state, the county, including Michigan City. In fact, as you talk about festivals, you know, they have the big Great Lakes Festival of the boat races. You know, we don't want to do something that will compete with that weekend. We want to make sure LaPorte people, residents here, are going over supporting Michigan City, the boat races and so forth, and then in turn when we have an event, hey, they're going to send all their people over for another weekend of things to do in our community. And so whether it's the county, whether it's economic development, whether it's Michigan City, we're working well together. In fact, the county's looking at getting dollars for the Kingsbury Industrial Plant, and even though that's outside the city, we support that 100%, and we need to stand with them as they try to develop that property. And it doesn't matter what's happened in the past. All we can focus on is mm-hmm. what's going on now and how can we be helpful to make that succeed, because those are jobs potentially for our community members.
Well, that's true, and we know that as far as the industrial park's concerned, the plans to expand and improve the railroad spurs to link up with CSX and with the CN Railroads bringing it into the park has got to lay nothing but new jobs and new opportunities for the city of LaPorte. You're not that far away.
No, we're not. We're a few miles away, and we need in the city to be supportive when they're having projects, and in turn, we expect their support of projects when we have things going on. So, you know, if we all partner together, LaPorte County, City of LaPorte, is going to be a great place to come visit, and hopefully we'll keep you here once you get here.
Now, Mayor Dermody, you've had a chance to tell us about some of the things you've encountered that you learned on the campaign trail that got you to the point now that you have the new administration in hand. Are there any things that maybe you have on your mind, things that you've talked to other people about or things you've thought about that you would like to get into, at least get established in 2020 and to continue on through the rest of the term?
Well, I think some of the things that I've talked about, really removing the truck traffic off our main thoroughfare, Lincoln Way, is something that's important important. We're working on some little things. You know, we've got also Newport Landing. How are we going to develop that? Let's get that developed. That's been going on a long time. And again, when the state basically mandated us to clean it up, we can't leave that contamination there. Cleaning up, we're starting to see some progress there. And those are a couple of things. But as well then, hey, let's get a plan on paper, in writing, of where we want to go. Let's get a financial plan. Let's get all the dollars so we all know together with our department team, department heads, which is our leadership team, to say, hey, let's figure out what everybody needs, what everybody wants. Let's prioritize it. We only got a certain amount of dollars, and then let's all work the plan together. One of the good things, I'll have a communication director coming on April 1st, and this individual will bring great things to kind of be that one voice for all our departments to let the citizens know what's happening.
Well, that's great to hear, and let's hope for some good things that happen as we get 2020 going forth. And thank you, Mr. Mayor, for being with us to talk about it.
Look forward to it, and call anytime, and we'll keep you informed.
We will. We've been talking with LaPorte Mayor Tom Dermody.
More people have been to the moon than to the Mariana Trench, the lowest point in the ocean. For mining operations around the globe, that means it's an unexplored area ripe for extraction. Will Hilton of The Atlantic joins us to talk about the dangerous and unregulated push to pull resources from the depths of the earth. That's next time on Think.
Tune in today at 2 o'clock here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Is coming back. That's definitely the feeling of many on campus as well as off campus. And we're talking about not only former students, but we're also talking about residents in Northwest Indiana. And to tell us more about how the campus is doing these days after having some shaky times, we have Dr. Bill Carroll. He is the former president of Benedictine University in Illinois. He owns a consulting firm which is called Hunter Global Education, and he is acting as a consultant as well as a spokesman for St. Joseph's College. And thank you very much for being with us on the program today.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Well, fill us in, if you will, first about some of the problems that came to your attention that the alumni and faculty members on campus brought to you and what the Board of Trustees has basically entrusted you to help take care of this time.
Well, I was aware of the struggles in the last couple of years and actually visited campus once with the former president just to have some conversation and some ideas. And I was invited by the former board chair. But going forward to 2017-2018, the board did something quite amazing. They voluntarily suspended accreditation because they saw the direction the college was going in. They weren't happy with that, so they kind of wanted to reboot. And if you look at the history of St. Joseph's, I mean, they have rebooted many times. It started as an orphanage. Mm-hmm. It went to a high school, then a junior college. Then they closed all that down and started a seminary. And then they closed the seminary, and then they brought back the high school and the junior college. And in 68, they admitted women. So this college is full of iterations, and this is just one more iteration.
What have been some of the things that have come up in recent months, I guess even years, that kind of signaled to the board that there were problems that they needed to take care of right away, and it wasn't going to be something that would be an easy fix?
Well, anyone who's following higher education in the 21st century quickly realizes that small institutions like St. Joseph's College and Rensselaer are not unique. Across the country, our small liberal arts institutions are struggling for enrollment. And I think 25 or 30 have gone out of existence in the last couple of years, which is a huge number. And going forward, the small liberal arts colleges, unless there are some kind of special niche college, are going to struggle to gain enrollment in a climate of, you know, the 18-year-old population decreasing. My thinking, and I think thinking of the board, is that liberal arts colleges for the future cannot do it alone. They're going to have to partner with other similar entities and provide a platform for joint programs where you can retain the mission, retain the college's identity, but do so in a much more financially responsible way.
Is this where you and the board got together and looked everything over and came up with this two-pronged approach, I guess, to be able to look to the future of St. Joseph's College?
Yes, the board invited me to come in and talk about, you know, academic programming and ways we might be able to bring the college back to some kind of credit programs on the campus. And I came in and we looked around and, you know, one of the things that's extremely important is when you give up accreditation, it's not easy to regain. It's a long process that may take 5 to 7 years, but it's doable. in the meantime, we want to get academic programs on the campus. So we came up with a two-prong approach. One is to create the St. Joseph's University Center, which will be a coming together of various universities in concert with in public and private institutions. And then it's the College Career Center, where we'll be offering certificate programs. And the first of those programs is in the Certified Nursing Assistance Program, and we begin classes there on March 9th. On the University Center side, we're pleased to announce that Ivy Tech started its first class in January, and they have a robust schedule to start on campus in the fall. Our goal then is to take in those first 2 years, and we will piggyback then into junior-senior years, where we'll offer specialized majors and also attempt to bring some special majors back to St. Joseph's College.
So you're really kind of taking the idea of a community college, the two-year college concept, and this, and I guess using it as a way to, as a springboard perhaps, to be able to build back into what you hope will be a four-year college?
Sure. Our traditional liberal arts colleges, and I did this at Benedictine, and I'm sure St. Joseph's did that, is we would accept students from the two-year college, Ivy Tech, okay, and invite them to campus for junior, senior. The change here is we're inviting Ivy Tech to the campus in the first 2 years, okay, and then the students will remain junior, senior year, or they can transfer out to one of our other university partners. You know, the beauty of bringing in the public is we can offer the first 2 years of college in a Catholic liberal arts, you know, college, St. Joseph's, and provide a good tuition-affordable program that then the parents can forward junior, senior programs at your more traditional liberal arts colleges.
Do you think that this is a plan based over the next few years that not only that the Board of Trustees feels confident in, but also the community of Rensselaer, Jasper County, all of Northwest Indiana for that matter?
The easy answer is I hope so, okay. And now we have to work to get the community involved. And I know there's a lot of feelings out there about what happened 2017-2018. The board came up with a comprehensive program called 128 Partners, and they went after 128 donors who would help support the college in the next couple of years to keep it open so we could get to that next iteration. That has been done. We've come up with this two-part plan that the board has approved, and in moving forward now that we have, you know, we have the University Center and we have the Career Center, now we need programs to run on those highways. And this is where we begin to reach out to the community. We don't want to build an academic program on the college credit side that does not respond to the needs of the local community. So we're going to ask for the input of the local community. What kinds of academic, you know, college degree-bearing programs do you want to see? On the other side of the scale, we have the Career Center, which is offering certificate programs. And those programs are geared to having students take X number of classes which result in a certificate where they're eligible for jobs immediately. And that's where that CNA, the Certified Nursing Program, is going to be an exciting program for us because students can go to that and then they can go to hospitals and that and apply for jobs.
We're talking with Dr. Bill Carroll. He's the former president of Benedictine University in Illinois, and he is also now the owner of consulting firm Hunter Global Education. He's been asked by the Board of Trustees at St. Joseph's College to help straighten things out and get them onto a path of certainly economic as well as educational success. When the tough times came here, and when they had to basically close the university down, a lot of faculty members left. What are you able to help with the board's help, able to do to help build things back up in the way that you want to do it with the approach that you have right now you're working with?
Well, Chris, one of the things, you know, I knew of St. Joseph's College, okay, but coming into this role now, you know, I travel across the country. I go to many academic conferences and meetings. I am just struck by the reach of this institutions across the country, across the world. I mean, I have people in California say, oh, my sister went to St. Joe's. You're going to bring it back. That's great. Mm-hmm. I think what the biggest thing is, now we have the idea of the kinds of programs we want to develop. This will only be successful if the community partnerships with us. Okay, we need community to reach back and embrace St. Joe's as their hometown college and help us build that college of tomorrow that's going to be financially sustainable.
I know that in the past here, not too recent past, I guess, Marion University, based in Indianapolis, was able to help St. Joseph's College out in a lot of cases. Are these some of the organizations, educational and otherwise, that you'd like to be able to build into the partnership that you're talking
about?
Sure.
We have, you know, an ongoing good conversation going on with Marion University and Ivy Tech, And there are about seven other institutions of which you expressed a strong interest, but I'm working on developing what I call the anchor program, the first 2 years of college first, and then bringing in those other institutions later on. And we're looking at associate's degrees, bachelor's degrees, online programming, graduate degrees, whatever this market will bear.
Well, it sounds like that you have the doors open, and there will be open for students here in the weeks and months ahead. And you have the gates open to the campus to encourage the community to get back involved again, too. If there are any key points that you haven't brought up necessarily, but that you want to bring up to let people know that St. Joseph's College is not dead, far from it. You've had some tough times, but you're coming back. What might those points be?
Well, if people commit, first of all, you said it, the gates open. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is the biggest sign of hope, okay? Now, we have a lot of buildings on campus. We are focused on the core building. The core building is a state-of-the-art education center. We're focusing on the core building to start offering our classes there and using that as the center, the epicenter of the rebirth of St. Joseph's College. The other buildings we will deal with as needed, but right now, the focus is the core building. And as I just said a minute ago, there are many institutions out there. This was not a Rensselaer, situation. This is a nationwide institutional problem among small liberal arts college. I think that St. Joseph's in Rensselaer can become a beacon of hope, okay, for the national liberal arts colleges facing the same situation. We were excited that today we appeared in Inside Higher Education, which is a national publication. It goes out to every college in the country. Mm-hmm. So St. Joseph's is in the news. It's good news. We thank the community for being patient. But the biggest thing is we invite community to get involved with us. Take a look at the programs Ivy Tech is offering. Look at our certificate programs, the CNA program, and think, maybe I should get involved in that. So we invite the community back to St. Joe's. We'll be working on things in the future to get the community back on the campus. But I think, the gates open. And I think we're soon to become a beacon of hope for other colleges in the country.
Well, Dr. Carroll, we appreciate you taking time explaining what the situation has been with the St. Joseph's College in Rensselaer and how that your help, along with the Board of Trustees, going along with the ideas, have been able to get things going. As you said, we've got things started again, and we'll be stronger with the two-pronged approach to education on the Rensselaer campus. And thank you for spending time with us to go through it. And we hope to have you back on again as things get better in the months and years ahead.
And Chris, anytime, okay?
Thank you very much. We're talking with Bill Carroll. He is the former president of Benedictine College in Illinois, and he is a consultant who's been working very closely with St. Joseph's College Board of Trustees in helping make things stronger and better for the campus in Rensselaer. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we'll have conversations with Jesse Carbonda and with Kim Ferraro with the Hoosier Environmental Council. More measures involving the environment are moving through the General Assembly these days, and we'll get legislative bill updates from both of them. We'll also bring you the conversation that Michael Puente had on his off-mic program with Gary attorney Tony Walker, talking in this case about Attorney General Curtis Hill and the problems that Hill is facing these days. It's all coming up tomorrow on Regionally Speaking, and we hope you can join us.